I'd open up your Bibles to Leviticus chapter 10, and we'll be looking there in just a moment. We are always grateful to be visiting with Pepper Road. It just feels like home when we visit here. I looked at the calendar, and I have been here more Sundays than not this year, I promise. But what's more is my meeting schedule is over for this year. Our intentions are to be here all of the Sundays for the rest of the year. So Ron can rest at ease. And I look forward to the coming weeks. We had a wonderful week this past week, and we're thankful for the opportunity to be there in Illinois. Luke and I were able to gain a lot of encouragement, and we hope we were able to give half as much as we received there. I want to look this morning at this very familiar account. In fact, if we're looking at the book of Leviticus, this is probably the most familiar part of Leviticus. It's the only narrative portion of that book. So much of it deals with rules and regulations that maybe we get lost in sometimes. And yet here's a moment where the story's pretty easy to grasp. Doesn't take long for it to happen. And it's not many verses. But what does happen here grabs our attention. And it ought to grab our attention. But what do we do with it? Well, let's begin by reading these first 11 verses of that chapter. It says there, "Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans, and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, 'It is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I will be treated as holy, and before all the people, I will be honored.' So Aaron therefore kept silent. Moses called also to Mishael and Elzaphan, the sons of Aaron's uncle, Uziel, and said to them, 'Come forward, carry your relatives away from the front of the sanctuary to carry outside the camp.' So they came forward and carried them still in their tunics outside of the camp, and Moses, as Moses had said. Then Moses said to Aaron and to his sons Eleazar and Ithamar, 'Do not uncover your heads, nor tear your clothes, so that you will not die, and that he will not become wrathful against all the congregation. But your kinsmen, the whole house of Israel, shall bewail the burning which the Lord has brought about. You shall not even go out from the doorway of the tent of meeting, or you will die. For the Lord's anointing oil is upon you.' So they did according to the word of Moses. Then the Lord spoke to Aaron, saying, 'Do not drink wine or drink strong drink, neither you nor your sons with you, when you come into the tent of meeting, so that you will not die. It is a perpetual statute throughout all your generations, and so as to make a distinction between the holy and the profane, between the clean and the unclean, and so as to teach the sons of Israel all the statutes which the Lord has spoken to them through Moses.'" I believe that this section does encompass those first 11 verses. I think the story does not end certainly in verse 2 and not even as the speech of Moses ends. But I think this speech to Aaron beginning in verse 8 is included. And I think you can see that section break in chapter 12. Then Moses spoke to Aaron and to his surviving sons. And so now we're moving on past that story. Though we're going to notice some things at the end of this chapter that I think still have to do with this. But I think that's important, and we'll make note of why that's important a little bit later in the lesson. What do you do with this? This is not the typical response of God to sin. It is not the only occasion of such a response, but it is certainly not the most common response of God to sin. We are more familiar with passages of God giving mercy towards sin. And it is uncommon enough that people do their best to try to explain it away. And they do that in a number of ways. There are people who try to find explanations for what happened here, some natural cause for the death of Nadab and Abihu. One commentator suggested that what had happened is they were experimenting with different ways to make fire, and it literally blew up in their face. And then the people interpreted that as God bringing judgment on them. But God doesn't do that sort of thing. Another interpreter, he said that they had been so thoroughly ingrained with the idea that you do not step even one step outside of God's instructions, that when they did, They were so overcome with guilt that they had a heart attack and died. Anything to not attribute this to God. Now, the problem with that is obvious. Not only is that a failure to recognize God's judgment here, but it also is a failure to recognize God's scriptures as inspired. And so there's all sorts of problems. But people will go that far. That's how far they will go to try to deny what they do not want to accept about God. They do not want to accept the severity of God. Behold the goodness and severity. They stop at that goodness. Behold the goodness. I do want to behold the goodness, but I want to behold the severity, and I want to despise neither one of them. And in fact, I want to find reasons to rejoice in both of them and see the beauty and the glory of God in both elements. I want to back up from Leviticus chapter 10 before we look with some attention at the particular text here in chapter 10. And let's think, first of all, what happened in the lives of Nadab and Abihu before they came to this event? Because one of the things that people will say is, what is going on? Why did God react so violently to the sin here? And I think if we trace their history, we can see that this is not a small misstep. I was having a conversation about this very story recently when a fellow said, what do you do with those places where God seems to lash out when people just make a small mistake? I said, well, I think one of your problems is that description, a small mistake. Is that what you think happened in Leviticus chapter 10? And he said, well, it just doesn't seem like it's this grand rejection and rebellion against God. And maybe his perspective needs adjustment. And maybe he's the one who has a false idea of what's happening here. So go back, if you will, to Exodus chapter 24. In Exodus chapter 24, Moses is invited into the presence of God, but not only Moses, but also Aaron and his sons and 70 elders of the children of Israel. It singles out Nadab and Abihu in particular, and so these two sons particularly were invited. It says Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel. And under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire, as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel. And they saw God, and they ate and drank. That's the kind of passage you just want to stop for a moment, and you want to try to get some perspective about what's happening here. I don't know. I mean, obviously, I don't know what they saw. I can't have a vivid idea of what that must have looked like. In fact, I know it must be something different than what Moses asked to see a little bit later. He asked to see God, and God says, that's not possible. You will not live. And he asked it in such a way to suggest that he's asking to see something he hasn't seen already. And so they're seeing God in some way that is less than the full view. You know, less than the face-to-face kind of view that we hope to see in heaven. But I guarantee you this, they're seeing more than we've ever seen. And they are seeing something that God has allowed few people to see. And in fact, he has already told them, he's already warned them that if these people approach the mountain, if they even touch the mountain, they will die. They are privileged to even be on the mountain, much less see what they're seeing. And God doesn't just allow them to come into that moment, into that scene and see things that so few are privileged to see on this earth and to live, but he says, sit down, eat and drink, have a meal. There is no communion so precious as what these people were able to experience. And Nadab and Abihu saw that. And so when we get to Leviticus chapter 10 and we wonder, what's the big deal? One of the big deals, I think, is they have forgotten so much about God. And they know him way better than we do. They've seen him more than we could see him, or at least in ways that we have not seen him. So you don't get up from eating in the very real presence of God, the very literal presence of God, and then go on and act casually towards God. And let me say, we'll emphasize this later. They are acting casual towards God. How do you see that and then go on in that manner? They have witnessed the sin in Exodus chapter 32 of the golden calf. Their father creating that golden calf from the gold that was given him by the children of Israel. And the consequences of that sin. The Levites, they are not named who it is, the Levites who took up their swords, but the Levites going and taking up their swords, they have seen the judgment of God there, but also the mercy of God. They did see the Levites striking down their neighbors. They did see the plague that came upon the people after they drank the powdered form of that golden calf. And yet they saw Moses stand in the breach. And they saw God relent concerning the destruction that he had every right to bring on the children of Israel. And let me emphasize again, we've talked about it before, but emphasize the nature of this sin. This sin is breaking the law at the most foundational level. When you look at Exodus chapter 20 and God begins to speak forth the law, the very first things he says, the very first commandments he lays out are the commandments they have broken. They have broken the law utterly because they've broken the foundations of the law. No other gods before me. And so, when we say that they are lawbreakers, that is, in the deepest sense of the word, they are lawbreakers. They've shattered it. And God has every right to say, the covenant was based upon you doing what you said you would do, and they did, there in chapter 24. And they were sprinkled with blood, sanctified to follow this. They didn't do it. And God has every right to say, now I will keep my end, which is you will be destroyed. And he doesn't. And he goes on with them and he continues to dwell with them and continues to give them instruction and give them a second chance when at the very inception they have failed. And they go on to build the tabernacle and get to see the presence of God in that manner. We get over into Leviticus and we see the sacrifices that are being described. And then as you continue on, those very sacrifices being offered, and particularly those sacrifices being offered for on behalf of the priests. They, first of all, must be cleansed. They must be atoned for. And so that is being done. And in addition to that, there is ceremony that goes along with that. There is the anointing of oil that occurs. And then later there is the very particular anointing of blood. Now they are sprinkled with blood, Aaron and his sons. But then in verse 23, it says Moses slaughtered the ram that's described there in verse 22. Moses slaughtered it and took some of its blood and put it on the lobe of Aaron's right ear, and on the thumb of his right hand, and on the big toe of his right foot. And he also had Aaron's sons come near. And Moses put some of the blood on the lobe of the right ear and on the thumb of their right hand and the big toe of their right foot. And then Moses sprinkled the rest of the blood around the altar. It's a peculiar ceremony, but it's one that's meant to get the attention. I don't want to go through much of any ceremony where somebody's smearing blood on me. But if I needed to go through that ceremony, the idea is you won't forget this sort of thing. If somebody came and smeared blood on your body parts and then, sprinkled you with blood, you would presumably not soon forget that. And I gather that the idea is there is a sanctification of the ear, the hearing of the word. And there is a sanctification of the thumb, the right in all these cases. That would be the strong side. culturally, that would be representative. You don't offer people things with your left hand. You do so with your right hand. And so it's the right side, the ear, the thumb being the idea of here are your actions are sanctified. And then, the toe, that is your movements, where you go, you are going in service of God. And presumably that's the idea. But all of these have been purchased and been dedicated to God. And so they are His. And they go through that whole ceremony. And it's solemn. And it should be very affecting. So that it's not the sort of thing that you quickly forget. Then in chapter 9, when the sacrifices are being offered not only for the priests, but then also for the people, and the consecration is being completed of the priests so that they can begin their service. Incidentally, that's where we leave off in chapter 9. The priests have been consecrated. They are ready for service. And chapter 10 picks up with what's the first thing they do. And we've already read what the first thing they do. At least that's the way it's written, presented to us. But notice the last thing that happens there in chapter 9. It says, fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the portions of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. What a scene that would be. To be not just offering the sacrifices, but to see God Himself providing the fire, reaching out and consuming those sacrifices. In every way, these men had all that they needed and a great deal more to be fully aware of the presence of God. I don't mean to diminish what we have and what we can know about the reality of the presence of God, but these men had no excuses to say we forgot. They had seen too much. They had experienced too much. And God had gone through this process of giving them all the clarity they needed to understand the severity, to understand the importance, the sacredness of the job that they had been set apart for. And so we need that. We need to see what comes up to this point. These are not otherwise, these are not people who are novices. They're not people who slipped up and made a mistake. And that's the way some people present it. Somebody slips up and bam, God strikes them down. We need to be careful we don't paint that kind of picture of God. God is not eager to strike people down. But what is it that is happening here? Well, looking at the sin itself and the way that it is described as a failure to regard God as holy, a failure to regard Him with honor. Moses says, it is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I will be treated as holy. And before all the people, I will be honored. Again, right on the heels of everything God has done to honor them. And that's what's happened. They have been given a position of great privilege. They have been given a position where they are able to have fellowship with God in a special way that no one else in Israel would know. Incidentally, it's the relationship God has given to us all now. Now we are a nation of priests. And so as far as connecting ourselves to Nadab and Abihu, this is what God says you have and the way you can come before Him. And so lest we think they are in a position that we are not, no, that's the position God has put us in. And so He's lifted them up and He's honored them, and they have scorned that honor. What exactly have they done in not honoring God? How have they not honored Him? Well, I think one thing that's likely is that their dishonor, their lack of reverence, was bolstered by alcohol. As you get down to verse 8, the Lord spoke to Aaron saying, do not drink wine or strong drink. This is not the only place God gives that instruction. That's made clear in other places where it is in the context of these are the things that the priests must do. But it's sort of shoved into this story. Why so? It's not the only place where something happens and God gives instruction concerning the incident right there in the context of that incident. Where he goes and says, this is what I'm saying. Don't do this. Be careful about this. It's sandwiched there with the commandment so as to make a distinction between the holy and the profane. And so that more easily, I think, fits for us into the context of what just happened. So I think as you're just reading through the context, this suggests that perhaps they had done that. They came lightly to their responsibilities. Again, Brett was talking in our meeting about the effects of alcohol. And one of the things that we see is this is not for priests. And we are all priests. Because we have work to do. And it takes care. Some people talk about being overcome with the sensation of how careful we have to be. Well, I think that there are people who have a distorted view of that. That's possible. And yet, I think there are people who think that somehow we should be able to go around without much thought about how we approach God. And that's just not the case. God requires great care. He requires great attention. He requires circumspection and sobriety. And so here he says, this is the consequences of setting down your sobriety. Well, not only that, but they did mix the holy with the profane. I think the easiest, the most straightforward interpretation is that they went and got fire from where they should not have gotten fire. That God says, this is where I want you to get that from. And whether they got it from outside the camp or just a fire, maybe even inside the tabernacle, that was not the fire. They went and got it from somewhere else. Now, again, the question is raised by some people, what is that? I'll say this, just because I cannot with 100% certainty say what it is they went and got that they shouldn't have, I don't doubt for a moment that they knew. That they had no confusion about what God wanted and what he didn't want. And let me say, that is a reasonable and in fact necessary conclusion from everything we know of God. We make that conclusion when it comes to Cain. How could Cain know what he was supposed to offer? I don't doubt for a moment that he could. For one reason, because it says by faith, Abel offered what was pleasing, and faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. You don't have faith if you don't base it on something that God has told you. And so that you could know. And I believe these men not only could know, but it is very easy to see that they have been involved in a great deal of instruction. And so God is not saying, well, I know I didn't make this clear, but turns out that's what I really wanted. And that is not the nature of God either. I think also a point to make there is that idea of what is profane is simply what God has not made holy. It's not that they went and got fire that was mixed up in some sort of idolatry or perversion necessarily. Profane in the book of Leviticus doesn't take on the same tone as the way we use that word. We use it to mean something rather vulgar. And even that word vulgar is changed in meaning. We mean it something disgusting, something nasty. But in their case, it's just something common. It's just something that's inappropriate for the worship of God. That could mean that you went and got utensils out of your kitchen instead of using the ones that were in the tabernacle. That would be profane. That could mean that you got fire from the fire that you use to warm yourself every night, which is fine to warm yourself, but it's not fine for using for God's sacrifices. And so we gain that from this, that when we approach God to worship, it's not just a question of, is this immorality? It's a question of, is it holy? Has God made it holy? And he makes it holy by asking for it. He sets it apart by saying, I set this apart. And that's all it takes, really. You say, how does something become holy? When God says it is. He says, these things are holy, these are not. That defines it. You say, we cannot make it holy, but he can. And so we bring him what he says. is holy. I do think that there is something to the hearts of the sons, Nadab and Abihu, and I think that that is illustrated or set in relief by what we see at the end of this chapter. Aaron's two other sons do what is contrary to the law. But the outcome is different. Why is that? It says in verse 16 that Moses searched carefully for the goat of the sin offering, and behold, it had been burned up. And so he was angry with Aaron's surviving son, Eleazar and Ithamar, saying, "Why did you not eat the sin offering at the holy place? For it is most holy. And he gave it to you to bear away the guilt of the congregation, to make atonement for them before the Lord. Behold, since its blood had not been brought inside into the sanctuary, you should certainly have eaten it in the sanctuary, just as I commanded." But Aaron spoke to Moses, "Behold, this very day they presented their sin offering and their burnt offering before the Lord. When things like these happened to me, if I had eaten a sin offering today, would it have been good in the sight of the Lord?" When Moses heard that, it seemed good in his sight. I don't know, at the final conclusion here, whether or not this is a legitimate justification. Perhaps what they did was in fact still wrong. They have more communication with God than what's revealed to us. I do know this, their reason for doing it is very different. Sometimes we're in a situation where there are no good options. And when they're offering their sin offering, when they're trying to gain atonement, and God says, "This portion is for you," it seems that their attitude is, "We do not deserve this. It's not right for us to get anything out of this." If they are wrong, they are approaching this much differently. This is not casual. This is an effort to give more reverence to God. I think there's a danger there too, and we need to be careful we don't head that direction. And it's do not turn to the right hand or to the left. And so both of those can be problematic. I get that. But God is far more patient with those who commit some failure because their attitude was, shall we say, overly reverent. I don't know if you can be overly reverent or not. But there's a sense that they're saying, "We do not deserve." And that sets them in great contrast with these men who go carelessly about their worship to God. I know in Moses' case, that's a fair argument. I mean, that seems to be the sense of Moses here. And so maybe one of the things that we can take for that is, and I think we definitely see this principle later on, it is one thing to deprive ourselves of what God has said we can have. It is another thing to take what God says we cannot have. And I think God will always show more patience with the people like the Rechabites who go and say, we will constrain ourselves even more than what God has said. Well, all of this is being done not only in the way it's described, but it's being done before all the people. And it's being done before all the people at the very moment when they've been installed as priests. And so their inaugural action is to ignore God. And I think that sets that sin on a different plane than a mere mistake, a mere, quote, misstep. So, is God right? On the face of it, first of all, this is not, I don't ask that question from the sense of if we can figure out how he's right, then we'll say he's right. He's right regardless. I know that. And I know it's not a matter of he has to justify himself to me. But what I also know is God spends a great deal of time in his word justifying himself. He does say, "This is why I'm doing this. I am being fair in how I'm conducting myself." And so, if we have this sense of unfairness, I do at least want to try to examine that and see if we can figure out how God has been fair. I know he is, but can we understand how he is? And I, in a conversation I had this last week, I think that was the the case of a young man asking that sort of question. He said, I'm not saying God is unfair. I'm saying I don't understand how he's being fair. I'm sure he is, but I don't get it. And I think that's an okay place to be. But I think we can move past that. I think we can see the fairness of God. It is not that God is simply lashing out, that he's been patient and patient, and now he just loses it. I think in the first place, we do see a possibility that Aaron is about to speak out. He's about to say something about what God has just done. Because when it says Moses said to Aaron, this is what the Lord spoke. When Moses put it into perspective, then it says, so Aaron therefore kept silent. So perhaps Moses just saved Aaron. Maybe Aaron sees this and Moses sees there's about to be, and he steps in and says, let me tell you what just happened here. And upon hearing that explanation, that's all Aaron needs. And there's a sense of, with his silence of, that's right. You're right. And he goes on to tell him how much he should maintain his silence and how far he should go in indicating his approval. We'll look at that more in just a moment. But I think that we need to be careful that we don't paint the picture of God as someone who just occasionally is in a bad mood and people catch him at the wrong time and zap. Maybe I think one of the places we've done an injustice here is in the case of Uzzah in 2 Samuel chapter 6. I don't know how many times I've heard a sermon on Uzzah where you think he's sort of like Cornelius. You know, just a devout man just trying to do the right thing, serving God in a bad situation. And doesn't know which way to go, and he reaches out and, man, just wrong place, wrong time. God thoroughly emphasizes through his law, do not touch my ark. Not only does he thoroughly emphasize that, he emphasizes it so great, not even the priests get that privilege. You do not touch the ark. It is holy, it is holy, it is holy. You don't even look at it. The priests go in, and as they're taking down the curtain, they walk and they put it over the ark. And nobody gets to even look at it. And so you recognize what God, the high plane that God has set that on, the emphasis that he has given, and you look and they throw it on the back of a cart. Uzzah should have said, I'll have nothing to do with this. I don't even want to look at that thing. That is too holy. It's a shock. The shock is that God didn't strike them all dead the moment that they even thought that this was a possibility. Instead, God lets it go all the way. He lets them profane his ark, and he lets them treat it as a common thing. And he doesn't strike until they go all the way to the point to think that they can reach out and grab hold of it. And he says, that's enough. This has gone too far. That's how we need to see that story. Not a man minding his own business serving God who just takes one little step and God says, gotcha. It's not the God we serve. God gives us chance after chance after chance. And when we've squandered them over and over, then he says, I've done all I can. And we are released to the consequences of our own sin. There's a man that was making an illustration of this, a college professor at a seminary. And he was talking about his students to whom he had given assignments. And in the first, these are freshman students, and in the first assignment, the big assignment paper that he had given, it was a class of 300, and about 50 came in and did not have their assignment. And he says, all right, I'll give you an extension. Get it to me in a couple of weeks, there'll be no penalty. And so about 50 had not had their assignments and took advantage of that and brought their assignments in the next week. the next assignment that was due, there were close to 100 who did not have their papers. And he says, All right, I'll give you another grace period. 2 weeks, and there'll be no penalty. And most of them had their assignment in the 2-week grace period. The third paper, 150 students, half the class did not have their assignments. He says, all right, that's an F. You know what they said? That's not fair. And he said, are you kidding me? And one of them said, yeah, that's not right. You ought to be fair. And he says, all right, Johnson. Let's see, back in October, your paper was late. I'm going to change that one to an F. He says, anybody else want me to be fair? And he said, they all turned into Aaron's and held their silence. I don't want you to be fair. I want all the mercy you'll give me. And here are men who grew to despise the mercy of God. There was a sermon that some of you may be familiar with from American history. And during the period of the Great Awakening, there was a preacher by the name of Jonathan Edwards that preached a sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. That gets taught to us in high school as sort of the hellfire and brimstone preaching that they used to do. And this picture of this God, angry and almost delighted at the opportunity. And it talks about dangling us like a spider over the fires of hell. That sermon has been grossly misrepresented. In that sermon, what Jonathan Edwards says is that we are hanging over the fires of hell on a thread like a spider's web. And God is putting his hands under us, keeping us from it. And what are we doing but poking and prodding him and begging him to remove his hands and let us fall? You see, we mix up mercy and fairness. We think that the mercy is the fairness and the judgment is the wrong. The judgment ought to be the regular response. And the mercy ought to be the thing that we're astonished at. And yet, no one says, why does God show mercy in Exodus 32? Nobody's asking that question. Everybody's asking the question, why does God show judgment? Well, that's what he should have been showing all along. The fact that they're still alive, that's the question. Why did they survive? God has shown patience with these men. And he's shown patience with Israel. And there comes a time where we exhaust the patience of God. In Exodus 10, beginning in verse 3, as we just noted, it says Moses kept silent. And he says, not only that, but you stay still. You don't say a word. You don't move. You don't even reach down to touch your sons who've just been consumed by the fire of God. Because what you do is you stand there and you say, that's right. And we need to stand by and look at the justice of God and say, that is, it's not just fair. God has gone beyond fair. The fact that he waited until that moment to show the justice. The fact that he allowed them to be priests. That's not fair. We shouldn't get to be priests. That's not fair. But hell, that's fair. That's what's fair for all of us. And I want us to take that away from the story of Nadab and Abihu. Yes, I want us to take away that God is serious about his commands. Yes, we can take away lessons about the silence of the scriptures and how God's word is authoritative, how we establish authority. Those are valid lessons. But take away this lesson as well. That we deserve God's judgment. We deserve it because we have all broken his commands. And all of Israel deserved this judgment. And the fact that God held it to these two men. It shows not only that he cares, but he cares about all of Israel. What Moses says is, if we don't stop this right now, the whole nation's going to be gone. We gotta draw a line. You see, this is just the beginning. You see, this would set us on a path, a course that will get us destroyed. And so just like with Noah and the ark, God wipes out the whole world. Why? To save eight. Because if he didn't do that, there wouldn't even be eight. And so he exercises judgment to keep from having to exercise it even further. And there's mercy here. There's mercy in what God does, even in his judgment. What about you? God has spared you up to this moment. Every morning you wake up, it's because God is merciful. I was so touched by Navitesh's story last week, and as he told it again during the camp that we were at, how he saw that in a car accident that almost took his life, it did not take his life. And he had opportunity to keep living and to come from idolatry to a knowledge of God, and he sees mercy. Just in the fact that he's still living is mercy. And the mercy allowed him, gave him an opportunity to come to God, and he doesn't want to squander that. What about you? Are you scorning, are you squandering the mercy that God has given you? You're alive today and you may not be tomorrow, but you're walking around like you're owed that. Like it's your right to go on living as long as you like, and it's not. It's not you. If you sin before God, your right to life ended the moment you sinned. And every breath after that is mercy. And we keep despising that mercy until one day God can no longer keep us from the judgment that we are pressing towards. What will happen is, just as it says here, that this is a fire, and God said he didn't know this fire, it was strange fire. What the New Testament says is, you'll be that strange person. You'll come and he says, I don't know who you are. I hope that you will put yourself in fellowship with God this morning. If there's anything that we can do to help you, why don't you come forward while we stand and while we sing.